This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. We're thrilled today to visit with a brilliant orthopedic surgeon. We're visiting today with Dr. Stefano Bini. And Dr. Bini is going to talk about his career, top priorities, what he's most focused on right now, what trends he's watching, and a lot more. Dr. Bini, can you take a moment to introduce yourself and tell us about your practice, UCSF, and a lot more?
Oh, for sure. So I'm Stefano Bini. I'm actually originally from Italy by way of Australia and then California. So, but I trained in the States and I'm now at UCSF, University of California, San Francisco. I'm an endowed professor of orthopedic surgery and I do primarily hip and knee arthroplasty. And that's been my surgical career. But in 1997, I started getting involved with technology and particularly the web, did a few startups back then. Had this crazy idea that patients would rate physicians and we were laughed out of the room. But then we went on and continued in this path. And now I am very involved with digital technologies and I run this conference called the Digital Orthopedics Conference San Francisco, where we really focus on technologies and how it impacts orthopedics in particular, with this year focusing on outpatient surgery.
And take a moment about digital orthopedics. What are you most focused on, most excited about? When you think about digital health and orthopedics, whether it's robotics or just the practice of orthopedics, or there's so many musculoskeletal apps for post-surgery, for physical therapy, for other types of things, and tracking, wearables, what are you most excited about?
That's a really good question. I mean, digital orthopedics sounds odd, but it's 1/5 of Medicare, as you know. It's a massive, massive vertical. So it's not like this tiny little subspecialty, right? And there's tons going on, and pretty much all the digital technologies can have an application to MSK. So if you're looking at AI, where I think AI currently has the easiest, biggest bang for the buck is in resource allocation, clearly shown to optimize OR workflows, clearly shown to be able to optimize clinic workflows. The value there, of course, is that you have a fixed asset. Now it's now delivering 10, 20% over what it did before, and that's all top-line revenue. So AI, applied AI, not the sexiest pace, but it's very, very cool. We're seeing robotics coming on strong. I think we're still in the early days. I just came back from the academy and I saw some early prototypes of some stealth companies, but also saw what the big boys are coming to the table with. And you're going to see an application of technology that will change the way we think about procedures in general in orthopedics. Augmented reality, I think we're poised to see a significant impact. What you're going to see, I think where it's going to have the biggest impact is obviously in spine surgery right now, it's having a big uptake, but where we'll be able to essentially have x-ray vision and apply it to trauma surgery is going to be a big opportunity. In virtual reality, it's training. And in 3D printing, I think it's one of those sleeper technologies that hasn't blown up yet, but has definitely impacted the manufacture of devices.
And talk about sort of printing technology. What does that mean exactly? Those of us that sort of we hear all this, what does that really mean in terms of the print technology as it applies to orthopedics and manufacturing body parts and so forth? What does that mean really?
Yeah, so 3D printing allows you to take a material, it's usually a powder or plastic powder, but there's some newer technologies in that direction, and create a three-dimensional object, right, inside a printer. And so far, you're like, okay, where's the value proposition there? Well, what's happened in orthopedics, particularly in spine, is this ability to now create shapes that you can't actually manufacture any other way. You can't print them, you can't stamp them, you can't bang them into shape. And these structures can have massive tensile strength and also compressive strength. So now you can actually create a disc replacement or a fusion block that's specific for a type of anatomy that you couldn't do before at a cost that's essentially minuscule because the cost of titanium isn't very high. The printing isn't very high, but you can actually then create these three-dimensional structures, which you couldn't do before, that are enabling. So where the value of technology in healthcare in general will always be is in whether or not it enables us to do something we couldn't do before using traditional means. Because otherwise, if it simply replicates a human process, it's usually not been terribly successful. It's when technology enables you to do something you could not do before, where you really see adoption. And in this case, in 3D printing, the biggest uptake has been in the configuration and manufacture of of devices that we could not previously do either cost effectively or just simply couldn't do it.
Thank you. When is the Digital Orthopedics Conference? When and where? May this year? When and where is it?
Thank you for asking. It's May 3rd, 4th, and 5th in San Francisco. May 3rd is dedicated to startups. We have a whole we call Bone Tank, or essentially a Shark Tank, and with a competition we're doing alongside Health Hub with Digital Health Awards. Thursday is dedicated entirely to the ASC, and that's a full day programming. And then Friday we have another half day, and that one is dedicated to AI and the future of AI, where we're going with solutions like ChatGPT and what they mean for healthcare, and then a session on value-based care. On the side, we have sessions with IDEO, the design firm, to help teams understand how they can innovate and learn to innovate and move forward in this new world that we're living in. And also, we have talks from McKinsey to also help us with change management, and a session for basic science that we're very proud of, where we're showcasing some of the best research in the space.
And take a moment on UCSF. Not everybody realizes, I think sometimes of UCSF is one of the best kept secrets in America. It's sort of a brilliant academic medical center, also does so many great things for the community. Can you take one moment and just talk about UCSF for a moment?
No, I agree with you. UCSF has some of the largest, and UCSF Orthopedics in particular has the largest NIH grants in the country, is the largest funded group of scientists. We're fully integrated with the other specialties outside of orthopedics, and we have multiple grants to actually support that integration from across the musculoskeletal specialties like rheumatic diseases and within and orthopedics. The university is independent, the University of California, San Francisco, Berkeley, which is the mother institution, if you will, but UCSF has always been independent. It's the only independent medical school within the UC system. But you're right about the it's always ranked sixth or seventh in the country, not quite as well known outside of California, but within on the West Coast, I think we're probably one of the preeminent, if not the preeminent institution.
And talk about, I know Dr. Bervin is there.
Yes.
And so orthopedics versus spine, when you think about orthopedics or spine at UCSF, and he's a phenomenal, Sig is also a phenomenal leader. What's better, the orthopedic program or the spine program? What's the better program, Dr. Beeney?
You know,
That's a trick question. That's not a fair question. I'm kidding. They're both magnificent programs, both magnificently led. So I say that with totally being facetious so as not to cause trouble.
No, but it's a good question. That turns out that the fact that you separated orthopedics and spine is telling in of itself. Spine actually is within orthopedics. With orthopedics is an umbrella that under which is pediatrics, which we're very strong in. Arthroplasty, I think we're very strong in. Foot and ankle surgery, all those specialties fit within. Spine has a special place at UCSF. Spine goes back to the early days with Dr. David Bradford, was chairman at UCSF. He brought with him a team, including Sig Bervin, who was originally his fellow, to lead, and also had the brilliant foresight of bringing Jeff Lotz into the group. And Jeff is probably the premier spine researcher in the country, the most largest grants that he has applied to the science of studying spine and spine motion. They actually have some really interesting stuff going on now using camera vision technology to help predict and treat spine injuries and perioperative care pathways. So I think Dr. Bervin is doing a fantastic job. In fact, he is always present at DocSF giving a lecture about the application of technology in spine.
No, I mean, he's a brilliant, brilliant surgeon and leader. You're a brilliant surgeon and leader. I mean, what a phenomenal place. So one more question. You're originally from Italy, moved here. Tell us just a little bit about your life story, if you don't mind sharing with us.
Oh, no, I've had a magical life in some ways. I'm very fortunate. My father is arguably one of the living most famous architects in the world, an innovator in his day. His name is Dante Beeney. He invented something called the Beeney Shell, which is inflatable buildings, if you want to make it super simple. But his career took him all the way to designing for NASA on the moon, and how would you build a building there? Incredible guy. And he was the one that moved us around basically as his career unfolded. We left Italy when I was 9, moved to Sydney, Australia, where I stayed till I was 16, had the good fortune of then coming to San Francisco, finished high school, went to Stanford, wasn't sure exactly where I was going to land. I was a political science major, spent some time one summer in Italy with this doctor who kind of convinced me I should be a physician, changed tack, went to medicine, went to Columbia University where I finished when I trained in orthopedics, came back to UCSF where I did my training. But then I went back to Italy. And this is interesting, Scott, because I was super well trained in the United States and I was kind of a little cocky about it. And I would go to Italy for a fellowship, at which point they kind of sat me down and said, let us show you our way of doing things. And in fact, at this big hospital in Bologna called the Rizzoli Institute, at that time in 1997, they were about a decade ahead of where we were in the United States. And that really opened my mind to keeping my perspectives open about what else is happening around me and in the world and not assume that everything I'm doing is correct. And so I've spent much of my career sort of challenging assumptions within orthopedics and looking at alternative ways of thinking. And I really want to thank my mentors at the Rizzoli for that year that I was there to really force me to really think outside the box a little bit and keep my eyes open. And that's sort of what happened when I came back and I saw the beginning of what became digital health and found a way to get connected to it as I saw it, very promising technologies for a future that will come.
Now, Dr. Pini, you must realize that you're not allowed to ever say something that says that the U.S. is behind in anything on the Becker's podcast. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm totally kidding. That's phenomenal. What a fascinating
experience. We've caught up. Scott, we've caught up.
No. I say it facetiously. We had a nephew who went through, you know, oh, my God, brain cancer treatment. And one of the educations I got from that experience was how far ahead different parts of the world are in different types of medicine and everything else. And it was just a fascinating learning experience in so many ways. So I say that completely facetiously. And it's fascinating to have the eyes open like that, isn't it? To see like the different ways in which people do things in other parts of the world and sometimes how much more advanced they are in different areas of the world in certain parts of medicine. Fascinating, right?
Let's reframe that. Rather than saying that someone is more advanced than somebody else, is that when you get to see things from a different perspective and you add to that perspective the one you bring to the table, you are much more powerful. You have a lot more insight. So what happened to me when I went to Italy is I got to double my perspective, if you will. And what happens now when my colleagues in Italy come to visit me, now it's a reverse. There, I've got young residents and fellows that come visit from all over the world, and they walk back, their eyes are open because there's so much that we do better in the United States. It's just that we don't do everything better. So
No. It's a wonderful perspective. I'm going to ask you another question because now it's like now that you know you've been in the United States basically forever. Now you talk about you were a poli-sci major at Stanford.
I was
poli-sci major at Stanford. So you must think now after studying political science. And watching the political system of the U.S., you must think, oh, my goodness, the United States has this mastered. They've got this brilliantly handled in terms of politics. Only the best and brightest as leaders. Can you respond to that? No, that's a joke, Dr. Pini.
I'll tell you what. Political science. What I loved about political science, unlike history, is that it teaches you to look at the same data set from different perspectives. So you're asked to look at the economy during a period of time and then explain it from a Marxist perspective, from a capitalist perspective, and look at all the different drivers from each different perspective. To me, that's the value proposition of a major like that to someone who's otherwise a scientist. So you look at the American system and you ask yourself, is this the optimal system? I think it's a darn good system for the country it inherited or that produced it. And we have to go back and keep in mind our history. It's not very similar to others. And it was always a bipolar system. And so the fact that we have two major parties in this country makes a ton of sense. You look at our country, the countries in Europe, that each of which have more than two mindsets, two influences. Italy was formed in 1860. It's a young country. It had multiple states within it when it was formed. Needless to say, we have a parliamentary system with 20 or 30 parties. It's a much more appropriate for that environment. So I think that the United States has developed a system that works well for it, where it does get into some troubles. It tries to export it into environments that don't really have the infrastructure to support it. You could talk about digital health. We can talk about clinical practices. Everything that tries to do that usually fails.
So I try and keep our guests for 10 to 12 minutes, but you have such a brilliant world perspective, I can't help but continue to ask you questions. Right? I hope you'll bear with me. I'm going to ask you one other question. We're talking, you've got a digital health conference coming up. Part of that revolves around venture capital funding in digital health. And just on the cusp of us talking, two things are happening. Last quarter was one of the worst quarters for venture capital fundraising in a very long time. Second, we're talking on the cusp of Silicon Valley Bank, sort of the most famous bank in Silicon Valley, just absolutely blowing up over some bad crypto bets, over being fragile to interest rate changes and so forth. Any thoughts? You have any thoughts at all on how this impacts funding for healthcare venture capital efforts or orthopedic efforts and so forth? Or is this just a blip on the radar and at the end of the day, people are going to keep on funding into orthopedics and digital health?
Scott, I am so impressed you know that Silicon Valley Bank imploded this morning. That's super fast. Good for you for knowing that. And also the causes for those crypto bets that didn't come around. Look, I talk a fair bit about the inevitable drivers of change, the things that are going to drive the adoption of technology. The current you and I can have a wonderful discussion about how wonderful the current care model is. I don't care. You pick your care model of choice. I don't think those are sustainable. I do not think that the care model today is, whether it's good or bad, is scalable. That's a terminology we like to use. We have an increase in demand, decreasing resources, and lower increased costs. To your audience, the drive to outpatient surgery is part of that attempt to try to mitigate the cost part of the equation. What we have to do is change the way we deliver care, not the care we deliver, but how we deliver it in a way that becomes cost-effective and appropriate for our populations, both in terms of distribution amongst social classes, gender, and also across zip codes and geography, because it's not evenly distributed. Now, that's the beauty and promise of technology. It's going to enable us to do that which we'd like to do, but we cannot do in the current care models.
But the point that you make about increasing demand and less resources, you could look at it in so many different ways, but very simplistically, in this country itself, 330 million people in a growing population, an aging population, 1,100,000 doctors, and certainly not an increasing amount of doctor hours, given that more and more of those doctors are working part-time and retiring and slowing down and so forth and so on. So in terms of leveraging physicians, we've got an equation that doesn't work. And so trying to find new ways to make that all work, and that's just the tip of the iceberg, because we all know you amplify that problem by the declining number of nurses, and so you've got more people, less caregivers, less providers. Are there some bridges to that other than just ending up, you know, as a country regressing to the mean in terms of the amount of care delivered per person? I mean, are there Scott, answers to that? I mean,
oh yeah.
Yes.
Oh yeah. Have faith. I'll give you an interesting number. In 1800, 70% of the world's population spent their time in a field producing food for the planet. Today, it's 2%, and we have an overabundance. It's not well distributed, but we have an obesity epidemic and overabundance of food production. That was a technological transfer of work from that we don't have to do, the machines now do for us. Those are mechanical. And what we're going to take is the healthcare piece of this equation that requires human intelligence input. That's where the issue is. We're going to be able to supplement it or support physicians with technology. We are running out of time in today's podcast. We can come back and talk about this for as long as you like, but this is what my conference is all about. It's about understanding and showing people where they can use technology to support their staff, to support the clinicians, to do the work that they can do and only they can do, but take off the menial repetitive tasks, while at the same time increasing access, increasing quality, and decreasing cost. And that is the future that we're looking into if we're brave enough and smart enough to embrace it. Now, the delivery class, those of us that are in the business of delivering care, and this goes back to what we said earlier, may like the current model. But if we continue to think of the future solutions to today's problems as being amplifications of a current model that does not have the resources to deliver it, we're going to be sadly disappointed. We have to rethink how we deliver care, not the care we deliver, which is where people get disconnected. They think it's going to be a robot delivering care. No, it's not going to be a robot delivering care. It's going to be a doctor whose workflow is supported by an AI engine who is doing surgery that is very reproducible thanks to a robot that is not prescribing the wrong medication because the software won't allow it. It's a drone that delivers medications to someone who's 30, 40 miles away from the nearest pharmacy and otherwise would have to drive there and therefore would miss their medication. It's a way to do 3D printing of devices so they're cheaper and less expensive. That's the future we're looking for. It just takes a little bit of leadership, but we'll get there.
No, thank you so much. A brilliant perspective. Dr. Beeney, what a pleasure talking. I have so many more questions. I will let you go, I promise. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. And thank you to our great producer, Grace Keller. Thank you very much.
Thank you both.